From minister to scam mastermind, Reed Slotkins quickly made a name for himself with Santa Barbara investors. Stay tuned to learn how one of the earliest Earthlink investors ended up conning hundreds of people out of millions of dollars. I'm Courtney Green.
I'm Katie Reeves.
And I'm Ezra Coopersmith. And this is Swindled and Psyched, the podcast where we explore some of the most successful scams and hustles in history, talk about why they worked, how they're still working, and what you can do to make sure you don't fall for them.
This podcast is brought to you by Better Business Bureau, Great West, and Pacific. The BBB has helped consumers find trustworthy businesses for over 100 years. With resources like Scam Tracker and online business records, finding trust in the marketplace is easier than ever. Visit BBB.org for more information. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of Better Business Bureau, Great West, and Pacific.
It always amazes me what people can get away with and for how long they can get away with them.
Agreed.
I really especially, don't know why it surprises me anymore.
Well, especially once we get all of the information and can look over something, it feels so clear and how does this keep happening? And then, I don't know, when I look at ones like this and we're looking at research for Ponzi schemes, the formula keeps on working.
Well, yeah, and it still happens. I mean, this particular story unraveled in the early 2000s, but it was happening in the 80s and 90s. Anyway, it's still crazy to me that you can get away with something for so long, but you almost, especially the ones that are current, these cons that are current, they almost always get caught and serve an enormous amount of time. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just, I don't know. I'm blown away at the length people go to cover up their lies. I mean, last week in episode 3, we talked about Gregor McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very dumb name. It's an 1800 story, so I don't know how they chose names back then. But I was blown away in that story by how far he was willing to go. He even wrote an entire book, came up with fake stats, fake everything to get away with this or with his scheme. And in this one, Reed Slotkins went to great lengths to cover up his S-word scam. So I'm just blasphemy.
No.
But I just can't get over. And other cons, almost said the S-word, other cons that we'll talk about in this podcast, they also just go to extraordinary lengths. I know we will talk about the Fire Festival at some point. Mm-hmm. And I know we will talk mm-hmm. about Elizabeth Holmes from Thanos. Oh.
That I know that those that level mm-hmm. is, yeah, it's incredible. Not mm-hmm. like in a good thing, just in the sense of how much effort and also the confidence. My goodness. Mm-hmm. Where it's, you think, wait, how did you think this was going to end? But,
right.
You know.
And here's
yeah,
the thing.
Me,
and this is why.
Uh-huh. That just.
Sorry.
continue to amaze me. No, it's fine. I mean, one is, yes, the fact that people can somehow self-justify, I mean, greed, basically, to say, no, I'm not stealing from people. I'm just kind of pushing the rules a little bit, and it'll all work out in the end. You know, this is good for my investors. But also, I mean, talk about, like, the Fire Festival. Like, I get how somebody would maybe go door-to-door and rip people off and think that they can get away with it. But when it's so mm-hmm. high profile and when you're dealing with, you know, such enormous sums of money as we'll get to in this episode, or something so public, that baffles me. The mm-hmm. ego involved in thinking like, well, this isn't going to come
yeah.
back to bite me. Nobody's going to notice that I'm somehow, you know, pocketing tons and tons of money.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to share this story. As always, I love sharing. I love doing the researching for these stories. And so let's get into Reed Slatkins and the Great American Greed. So after losing his father in a tragic accident in his teens, Reed Slatkins discovers the Church of Scientology. In 1974, he dedicated his life to it and became an ordained minister and teacher for the church. While learning more about the religion, he even spent summers in England being taught by the leader and founder of the church. He was a minister with the church for over 10 years when he realized that he could make a lot more money by working in stocks and bonds. So he moves his family from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara to start his new career. After minimal training by an actual stock professional, Reed transformed his garage into an office and started marketing himself as an investment trader. At first, he was mainly just investing for friends at the church. As word got around and Reed picked up more and more clients, he started to tell his investors and those who were interested that giving him their money was, and I quote, "safer than putting your money in the bank." One of his first major investors, Daniel Sade, claims that he heard about Reed through mutual friends in the church. Feeling confident that Reed could help him make all of his financial dreams come true, he refinanced his house and handed over his life savings, which was roughly $400,000. By 1986, Reed claimed to be investing over $7 million for his friends, family, and Scientology members. Reed claims that he wasn't really investing in anything risky, but in his quarterly reports, he was showing that there was nearly 25% gain for his investors. The truth was, he was actually losing their money. Though, as long as Reed could continue bringing in more cash, the scam would go undetected. He would pay off old investors with money from new investors, which slowly built up his credibility. Old investors became repeat investors, and they would tell their friends about this amazing man who was making them gobs of money. To the public, Reed looked like a new investment trader that had just figured out the system and knew where to trade. In a few short years of investing, Reed reported his company to be consistently investing upwards of $25 million at a time. As his business grew, he attracted the attention of Hollywood stars and fellow wealthy Scientologists. They would sometimes literally line up at his door to invest with him. As he reported to clients that their wealth was growing, it became clear that Reed's wealth was also growing. He started buying expensive cars, art, technology, and even moved his family to an exclusive community in Santa Barbara. His reputation continued to spread, and he ended up with clients who would hand over nearly $25 million each. His new social circles introduced him to the idea of investing in the early startup Earthlink in the late 1990s. He invested nearly $75,000 of his own money with the company. 3 years later, the company went public, which earned Reed about $100 million. This showed those who doubted Reed that if he was willing to invest and risk his own money and made huge returns, that they could trust him. It turns out, though, that Reed just got lucky with that investment. In 1999, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission started their investigation on Reed. The commission quickly learned what Reed was doing by paying off old investors with new investors' money. So, your typical Ponzi scheme. Then they decided to confront him. He denied doing any wrongdoing and claims that all of his financial statements to his investors were correct. Even though he denied doing anything wrong, he felt the need to throw the SEC off his trail by telling them he was closing up shop and liquidating all his accounts. For a year, he showed proof that he was liquidating these accounts, though all the documents he turned in were fraudulent. In a scramble to pay back his investors looking to cash out, he started to borrow money from short-term investors. Reed's final con, and the con that ultimately got him caught, was with John Poitras. I really hope I'm saying his name right, but it was for a $15 million investment. Reed had promised him in an investment plan that he could get John's investment returns up to 60% a year. A few weeks after taking the deal, John had a gut feeling that he needed to get out of the deal, but Reed was proving really hard to get in touch with. John stated in an interview that Reed always had an excuse as to why he couldn't be reached by phone or meet up in person. With more and more investors starting to worry and wanting to cash out, Reed created a story that would help him get investors and the SEC off his back. He told them that he had $500 million tied up in Switzerland accounts. Turns out that bank address was just a mailbox in a rundown part of Zurich. He generated dozens of documents and statements from this supposed Swiss bank to give to the SEC and his investors, proving his story. Reed went to such great lengths to keep up with his lies that he even created a European phone number that would ring like a long-distance call, but forward back to his personal phone. After 6 weeks of Reed dodging John's attempts to reach out, John filed a civil lawsuit against Reed, which ultimately resulted in the freezing of his assets. This meant that Reed couldn't carry out his scheme of borrowing more money to pay off old debts. In May of 2001, Reed realized there was no way out and filed for bankruptcy. Not even 10 days later, the SEC sues Reed and the IRS and FBI raided his office. What agents found was literally nothing. There weren't bank statements, investment statements, or even proof that Reed was investing their money at all. After his arrest, Reed pleaded guilty to all counts of mail fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy to obstruct justice. He had scammed more than $600 million from more than 800 investors over a decade. In interviews after his arrest, Reed claimed to have gotten in over his head. His initial intent was to be as good as his reports, but instead of admitting his failures, he created false documents to back them up. This was truly a snowball effect scheme where it just kept getting bigger and bigger. In September of 2003, Reed Slatkin was sentenced to 14 years in prison and died in prison of a heart attack in 2015, just 2 years shy of his release date. And that is the story of Reed Slatkin and the American greed.
It gives me so much anxiety just to hear that story and the way it snowballed and to imagine the oh no, I effed up moment that he must have
Which
had.
One? My God.
That's true. I guess they just got bigger and bigger.
Which one? And I just keep thinking, Reed, my man, call it a day. You know, when you said you were liquidating your assets.
Why? You should. You should have.
It's really interesting to me that he would rather risk going to prison than admit to the few investors he had in the very beginning that he isn't as good as he wants to be yet.
I think, and again, this is completely my opinion. In terms of the research, this is not the angle I went at. I will say, though, whether in this particular type of crime or other crimes that we see, if people have a large enough ego and they would rather risk the consequences, and who knows, they may be deluded enough to think that they will be able to figure it out and get away with it because they have previously. Mm-hmm. I think it's so hard to admit being wrong that people are willing to do and admit that you didn't actually know what you were doing and you are what you have created is truly a fraud. I think people would rather risk going to jail or death.
I don't think he knew he was going to die.
No, I'm not saying he. I'm just saying in general, you have people who would rather die than admit that they are a fraud or what this idea of themselves is a fraud. Again, that's just my opinion. That's not based in any research I did.
Well, it's also like, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Talk about the mindset of a scammer. Sorry, swindler, bamboozler.
bamboozler.
And you have to wonder, you know, did he go into it kind of thinking like, well, I'm just going to do what I can, get as much money as possible. Or was it a gradual process of pushing the envelope? And, you know, I'm in some hot water, so I'm going to, you know, I can't pay back this one investor, so I'm going to push the rules a little bit. I'm just going to get a big account and use that cash to pay this other person. And then it slowly, slowly spirals until one day you wake up and you're like, I'm running a massive Ponzi scheme. And I'm going to do anything I can to cover my butt.
I'll use this money from these investors to get it going. But once I really get great investments, I won't have to use this money. But he wasn't that good at investing.
Exactly.
I mean, he lucked out with Earthlink. It just sounds like he wasn't experienced. But I will say, if people are interested, and again, this is just one report from a professor and who's also a certified fraud examiner. I didn't know that was a job, but it is. I did come across a PowerPoint that was presented at a conference that is public information called The Psychology of Fraudsters. Again, this is one person's project, research that they're presenting, but we can add that to the show notes if people are interested to kind of see what this professor and certified fraud examiner has to say about a typical profile for an individual who would be involved in a Ponzi scheme, meaning the perpetrator.
Ooh, I'm interested.
Yeah,
me too. Are you going to tell us about it?
No, I was going to come, and I only have so much time. I wanted to more so focus on tips for what possibly to look for if you are potentially becoming a victim of a Ponzi scheme.
Ooh, okay.
So that's more of what I wanted to touch on today. So I will continue. Yeah, so I came across doing this research, and it seems like there has been, you know, because we have talked about, you mentioned, Courtney, that these were happening in the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s, but also, I mean, after that, with Bernie Madoff was a big, relatively more recent one that happened. And after that, there were some additional studies that were being done to look at, okay, this model continues to happen, and even when we provide information about it, people still become victims of it. And that's not to say, oh, why are those people being so stupid? No, because, you know, looking, there's a study I came across, which was done in 2012, and we'll, again, link it in the show notes so you guys can take a look. It's called Understanding a Ponzi Scheme, Victim's Perspective. So this researcher looked at 17 Ponzi schemes or cons that would fit that definition and spoke with victims across those different ones to gain more information, but also see if there are any patterns that are emerging. What I thought was interesting is everybody was introduced through word of mouth. And which is interesting because now businesses definitely still do that. And there's nothing wrong with word of mouth. It's interesting, though, with this particular type, that's still what they're relying on. They're not trying to advertise it online. They're not trying to get people to come in through, I just heard about it. I was Googling and I came across it. Specifically, they're getting people to know about it through people they're already familiar with. And that's a really big piece of this based on the research. So word of mouth. So again, coming from a trusted source. And so they all had personal or professional ties to other investors. So again, that familiarity piece. And most did not do additional research or due diligence before investing, again, because my coworker is doing it, my friend's doing it, and they're seeing success. There were a couple of people who did additional research. Unfortunately, it didn't turn up anything when it should have in one particular case. I'll get to that. The other piece of it is that when the perpetrators of these schemes were presenting how much the return would be, they're not saying, it'll be 60% a year, because that, to most people, especially because the individuals they studied had at least some experience in investing. So if you have even just some experience in investing, a 60% return in a year is just not believable to most.
You also can't really guarantee a return at all, right? You don't know what the market's going to look like.
No one should be guaranteeing any type of return when it comes to investments. I'm sorry, especially...
Okay, Jesus.
We won't get to that, but... that's a separate... sorry, did you want to say something additional?
No, I was just thinking, like, I've never invested in anything. I've only ever, like, the only big money I've put anywhere is buying a car. And so even I know you can't...
You know,
Courtney... not to shame anybody, I get it. Like, the idea of winning big or getting a lot of money is enough for some people to risk it. But really, investing is a risk.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also something you have to keep in mind.
Guys, now this may be controversial, but P.S., if we look at everything that happened with GameStop stock...
That's not controversial at all.
Come on! Like, it's not like the... It's not like investment stock. It's not operating. And granted, I agree, Courtney. I don't really know anything about investing because, my generation usually has to work two or three jobs to, you know, be able to pay our rent. But anyway... Right. So, you know, we're also investing in stocks. Get out of here. But if you are doing that in our generation, a tip of the cap to you.
For real.
Okay. So getting back to looking at this study. So, yeah. So they weren't presenting it as the largest percentage of return that was reported in this study was a 10% return per month. That is huge. So in terms of the 60% return, what most people, and so a 60% return per year is what, you know, it feels unbelievable. However, when you present it at 5% return per month, which is the same thing, that is much more believable because it's a smaller amount. So it sounds like, that's something that is more viable. 5% return a month. But again, that is a 60% return per year. So it's breaking it down into more manageable pieces that sound more believable. I thought going into this, I thought maybe there would be a timeline as well or a pressure to commit to the investment so that people don't have a lot of extra time to think about it. Pressure to commit wasn't an issue though. That wasn't really something that they reported either existed in that when they were meeting with the perpetrator or they just, you know, didn't bother them. So that wasn't really a factor. There were certain characteristics that may have made the person feel more comfortable, the person who's running the scheme. So, you know, if they were showing signs of charitable works, religion, the promoter or the perpetrator's charisma, indicating any special expertise or specific strategy. Those were things that this person seems a bit more trustworthy. It wasn't necessarily, people didn't report, you know, I wasn't comfortable investing and then I found out he was religious, so I did. Wasn't so much about that. More than, I just appreciated and trusted this person more because I can relate to those characteristics.
That's a factor that we see in totally other types of other sorts of scams. Like sometimes for rental scams, as an example, the supposed landlord will throw their religion in and say, like, I'm a practicing person because with all other things considered, it, you know, adds a little bit of credibility or it lowers your guard.
I like to think of it as a, like, I'm playing the morality card.
Exactly.
Well, I'm doing all these bad, or what we consider bad or illegal things, but I'm a blah, blah, blah. I'm a Christian. I'm a this. I'm a that. Well, that's fine, but that doesn't also mean that you're not doing nefarious things. Anyway, not trying to be controversial. Just saying that, you know, if someone tries to play that card in a situation that you feel like, I don't know, I'm not comfortable with this, don't let that distract you. So really what it came down to with this study, really the thing that people reported was their hook, what made them feel comfortable investing, was that they were introduced by someone they were familiar with. And that was the piece that really made them feel comfortable. And seeing that for depending on where in the stage they invested, you know, even if you're looking at 4 or 5 months, well, with the Ponzi scheme, you may not necessarily see anything happen that would pose a red flag because they're utilizing funds from investors. So in a span of 4 or 5 months, you may not see anything. It may take years for you to realize that this whole thing was built on the money put in by investors and new investors. And so, you know, if you do know someone who may, you may think they are being a victim of this, or you are someone who has been, I don't want anyone to feel as though this is something to be ashamed of, because even when you do additional research, I mean, you shouldn't be ashamed of it anyway, but even if you do additional research for Ponzi schemes, you know, you, one person hired a private detective to look into the background of somebody and they did not catch a charge that was on there. However, but I do want, you know, of course, if you have something on your record, that doesn't mean you're going to con people for the rest of your life, obviously. However, they hired the private detective to find anything and they failed to come across that charge. And who knows?
Perfect.
Well, exactly. And who knows if that particular charge would have been anything that has to do with finances or who knows. Mm-hmm. So there were people, and there was another who watched the investment of his friend for several months, didn't see any red flags, saw that they're, you know, because of course they're getting a return because the person's just funneling money from other investors. So we thought, yeah, it's working. They are getting this return. I am going to invest. So yes, these keep happening. It's not super surprising because, unfortunately, this just is a formula that tends to work. Mm-hmm. So I would say takeaways. I mean, again, this is just a tough one where what really hooked people was that word of mouth, friends and family, seeing those investments. So I would say just, again, we said that doing due diligence may not always turn up red flags. It's just when you're investing money, it is a calculated risk every time. Again, I don't really know a lot about investing, but it just seems as though there's not really a guarantee. And
like, if there's one thing to know about investing, it's that it's a calculated risk.
Yeah, so it seems to be a calculated risk. And, you know, make sure, hey, if you and your friends are investing in something and someone notices a red flag, please don't ignore it. It doesn't mean that anything is necessarily, I'm in part of a Ponzi scheme. But there are, you know, hindsight 2020, but along the way, there usually are little red flags popping up. And if you feel uncomfortable about an investment, really pay attention to that.
Well, what freaks me out about this story is that it was now 30, 40 years ago when it was happening, and the falsified documents looked so real back then, and mm-hmm. technology's come so far since then, mm-hmm. that I feel like if someone really wanted to get as far as Reed Slatkins did, it wouldn't be that hard. And that's what freaks me out about investing, is I know there are legitimate people to invest with, but you also hear about brokers running away with all of investors' money too. So I'm just,
I don't know. Should we say
burnt?
Don't invest in someone who's in there. No, I was going to say don't invest in someone who's running it out of their garage.
Well, I don't think he was doing just that kidding. For very long.
No, I'm just joking. Also, if you are running a business out of your garage, no shame in that.
Especially since rental prices are so high right
Heck
now.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm. Heck yeah.
But it really does. It makes me wonder what these look like now. And I think, Ezra, you can probably shine some light on that. But
I can't.
I'm just so curious. I have so many questions.
Yeah. Well, I guess in part, I'm kind of going to carry the torch of what Katie was talking about when it comes to what we know about who tends to get looped into these schemes. But the first thing I wanted to talk about was, and I've probably touched on this subject before, but investment fraud is a really good opportunity to kind of talk about the different types of fraud that we see at BBB. So what I did was I pulled up the last year of scam tracker data that our BBB, so our service area in the Northwest, has received. And I think it illustrates this perfectly. So we've talked, maybe we haven't, but close to, I think it's 40% of the scam tracker reports that we get are for online purchases. And those are an example of bamboozles in transactions. I'm blanking. I'm trying to use every word in the book other than the S word. Transactions for, usually they're not for very much. I think the average is probably like under $100.
It's 40. But they, 40? 40? 20 to 40, yeah.
I can actually look. I have it right here.
See, yeah. Okay, everybody who's listening, Ezra has the hookup. So he works in our investigations department at BBB, and he gets all the good data. I don't know how you guys pull it up so quick, or if that's just all something you guys are so used to share pulling the goods. Up.
He has all the tea, Sham. As the youths say.
That's the youths were youths.
Well, I mean,
you're considered Courtney. Youthful. Your 30s is still incredibly
we're all youthful. Well, anyway, so I can actually give exact numbers. So for online purchases, and keep in mind, this is the last year just for our service area, just for the.
So this was 2020.
The past 12 months, so okay. Mostly 2020 so into 21.
This it's we're in April right now, yes. And so we also have to keep in mind that most purchases entirely in 2020 were online due to the pandemic. So I feel like it's that's a good little like pre.
Yeah. So keep in mind that these numbers aren't going to be completely representative of, every single
sales all time.
Exactly. Yeah, all but time just sales. To give an idea, because I'm trying to kind of illustrate two extremes of the types of fraud that we see. You know, in that time period, in that location, looking at online purchase scams, they're about 43% of the reports that we get. And the median loss for a consumer to report is about $100. So again, these are low dollar amounts going out to lots of people. But let's look at the investment category for comparison. Again, past year, Pacific Northwest service area, they account for less than 1% of the reports that we get, of the total number of reports. They're about 0.7%. But the median loss that a person reports is $7,000 exactly. And that's more than double for any other of the about 30 categories of fraud that look at. And there's a name for, I may have mentioned this before in this podcast, there's actually a name for this type of fraud. It's called high touch. And for reasons that I'll talk about later, that's important because the point is that it's personal. It's usually personal. This is not somebody sending a spam text message to thousands or millions of people and hoping to get a few in return. These are you know, schemes where the person behind it usually gets to know the victim. Sometimes it unfolds over time, and there's a human element.
Curse that familiarity, I'm telling
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Well, familiarity is the word here because,
yeah,
you know, to tie it into what we know about fraud victimization, one of the more unexpected pieces. Can you guys hear that?
Wait, what is that? What is it?
They are drilling in the apartment next to me. I think it's gone.
Oh, I can hear it.
I feel like they might be putting together IKEA furniture.
I mean, that's a good Friday activity. Yeah,
especially I love putting together IKEA furniture.
I don't know what it is. It's like a fun puzzle.
Ezra, I will fly you out next time I order furniture from them. It is the bane of my existence.
It's back, the noise. I love it. I get all the boxes in. I put like my favorite sitcoms on the TV in the background and just go to town.
Jam with your furniture. Exactly. I like podcasts, but yeah, get a podcast going. Lay the directions out, get the parts all set up. Ooh, follow. Anyway, I won't get
in the
into,
same okay. way. And then I have to like chase my cat away so he doesn't eat a screw.
All right, well, let's work through the IKEA furniture being put together next door.
Love it. Okay, anyway, so investment schemes. One of the counterintuitive things that we know, and also keep in mind, it's really hard to get accurate data on scam victimization because, you know, for one thing, people tend to underreport, and we don't know that everyone underreports consistently, so there's some reporting bias. So, you know, keep in mind that this isn't perfect. But what we do know is time after time when people are surveyed or just looking at these big data sets like BBB Scam Tracker, people who are highly educated, are older, and are financially literate are prime victims for these scams. And I guess after listening to this podcast episode, that might not sound surprising. But when you think about it, you'd think that people who aren't financially literate would be the ones falling for these schemes, and they're not. And, you know, one of the reasons why, and some of this is speculation, is that scams, falling for a scam, I just said the S word twice.
Oh no.
Is not just about what you know, it's about how it unfolds, and it's about that personal element. So again, you know, familiarity here is the key word, but when we look at how these Ponzi schemes happen, how the people who perpetrate these scams get new investors, they're not getting them because they're putting out advertisements and these investors look through kind of the market fundamentals and make the, you know, they're doing it through their personal networks and through word of mouth and through hyperbole by saying this guy's going to make you tons of money. So what happens is you have these people who consider themselves financially literate and think, well, I'm not somebody who would fall for a scheme. That's for other people. That's for people who don't know what they're doing with their money. But they're not really making that evaluation based on any particular market knowledge. It's their gut. It's their personal relationships. The drilling is back. anyway, so when it comes to, you know, things that you can do to avoid these types of schemes, even if you're not very wealthy but are thinking of throwing a little bit of money in, just think, you know, what am I getting excited for? Do I really understand this opportunity? Do I have a chip on my shoulder and think this isn't going to happen to me? Because newsflash, it can. And also, we actually, in training sometimes, go through these skits or have scripts. and we have these little scripts of how to basically say no to an investment opportunity. Mm. And it's not that you should always say no, but the idea is that you should be comfortable, basically, even if it's somebody in your network saying, I'm going to think about this.
That's so smart.
I think that's a great point, because people may not want to admit this, but sometimes we just aren't comfortable saying no or don't have the language to do so. So we just, okay, we'll give this a shot and see how it goes, even though I'm not feeling 100%. So that's a great resource, Ezra. And I was also going to say, if you're looking to invest your money, we're not saying that, therefore, everything's a Ponzi scheme. Don't invest anything. Hide money under your mattress. That's not what we're saying. It's more, you know, if you're looking for to invest your money, vet your sources as well as you can. Go through the due diligence and guys, this is a BBB podcast. We've got accredited people who could help you with that, or accredited businesses that you can connect with to walk you through investments, how it works, some ideas. They can put a portfolio together for you. So head on over to BBB.org and look for some financial planners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great plug. And then if you're really feeling like maybe the person that is a second or third second or third person relationship,
friend of a friend, or like a third,
exactly, yeah. Or my sister's cousin's brother's, whatever. Anyway, if it's your sister's cousin, it's also your cousin. Anyway,
it's been a long week, everybody.
Moving on. Just make sure that you're, one, comfortable saying no, and two, Scam Tracker is there. If you think maybe this is going on for a long time, or that someone else might have reported it, bbb.org/scamtracker. Super easy, super helpful, easy to search, worth it every time. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to hear more stories about the biggest scams in history, how they worked, how they're still working, and how to stay safe from them. Until next time.